This is Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, your daily voice in Washington, D.C. on the issues of faith, family, and freedom. And now, here's your host, Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome once again to Washington Watch. Coming up, the national debt clock has passed $20 trillion. Are there any fiscal reforms on the horizon? Any relief for taxpayers in sight? That's what I'll ask Oklahoma Congressman Steve Russell when he joins us in just a moment. Also, God as a living reality, world immersed in fog. Fox News chief religion correspondent Lauren Green joins me to talk about her new book and the Truth Conference 2017 that's taking place in Baton Rouge this Friday and Saturday night. That's coming up later here on Washington Watch. And Dr. Carol Swain, an African-American professor of political science and law, is labeled by the Southern Poverty Law Center because, according to them, by her conservatism, she is expressing hatred toward minorities. Dr. Swain is here to explain. The website, TonyPerkins.com. If you're on Twitter, it's at T. Perkins. Hey, by the way, if you check out the website, April the 17th through the 27th, we'll be taking a trip to Israel, and you can join us. Michelle Bachmann, former congresswoman from Minnesota, will be with us. General Jerry Boykin, Ken Blackwell, former ambassador to the United Nations, and best-selling New York Times author Joel Rosenberg will be on the trip as well. Find out more, go to the website, TonyPerkins.com. All right, the national debt reached $20 trillion. $20 trillion. That's a T. For the first time ever last Friday, after President Trump signed a bipartisan bill temporarily raising or extending the national debt limit for 3 months. With us now is Oklahoma Congressman Steve Russell. He represents the 5th Congressional District of the state of Oklahoma, and he serves on the House Committee on Government Oversight. Congressman, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Well, thank you, Tony. It's always a pleasure.
All right, let me ask you this question, Congressman. Are there any fiscal reforms on the horizon? Is there any relief out there for taxpayers when we see this increasing debt that is accumulating pretty rapidly?
I don't know that we have any collective effort that is a bipartisan effort to rein in government spending. I wish I could give you optimism on that. Several years ago, Dr. Coburn, former United States Senator from Oklahoma, he had pointed out in his waste book ways to find waste and then try to implement that into policy. But we've tried to continue that effort with our Waste Watch series. We're on number 7 now. James Lankford, also from Oklahoma, has his Federal Fumbles, where he highlights and points out this. Jeff Flake, others. I think what I've resigned myself to, Tony, is that if every member individually would go out and find $1 billion in the course of a year to cut, which is readily achievable, then 535 members of us, that roughly equates our annual deficit spending, and we could stay within our means. We got into this one bad habit at a time, one poor policy at a time, one little spend at a time. And like the American public, where, you know, we credit carded this and overspent that. Right. Before you know it, we're like, oh, my gosh, I've got all this debt. I think the only way out of it is a little at a time. My first term in Congress was able to save $4.4 billion. This year, we're on track to save roughly $2 billion out of a It is a fuel-efficient vehicle fund. Okay, that sounds nice, but the problem is this fund, which is real money that's already been set aside, and it is festering there, it has not been applied for a loan of any kind since 2011. So it's not even being used. $16 billion that could have been used for Harvey and Irma relief. It could have been used to pay our debts and interest. It could have been used for any number of things. We have options out there without just saying, well, you know, we just can't get to it, so let's run up the debt clock. It's absurd.
Is it a sense of, you know, it's just been going this way, and so, you know, what's the big deal? You know, let's just keep doing things as we have. I mean, look at what happened when Barack Obama became president of the United States. The nation's debt was I think we were at, let me look at my notes here. I think we were right at 10, right around $10 trillion. Dollars. I mean,
that's
pretty
sure I've heard.
I think of 10.6. Here's my 10.6 in January 2009. When he left office, it was 19.9 trillion. He added more than any other president in the history of the country. And in fact, under the first portion of President Trump's in his early days, we actually saw the debt fall by $100 billion, but that was erased last week, and we're back on track of accumulating debt. But it's almost like there's not a sense of urgency because we've been doing it, and there's not been a problem. The sky hasn't fallen. But there does come a point in which this debt, it becomes irreversible. It becomes a huge problem for our economy, and it's a drag on the growth that we need to sustain our quality of living.
Sure it is. It's just like in your own household. If you're carrying a lot of debt and you have interest payments that you're having to make, that is not money that is working for groceries or working for gas or working for entertainment or working for anything. It is just money that is enslaved and working for somebody else. It goes back to the biblical principle, the borrower is slave to the lender. And that is what we're seeing. And to give you direct implication on that, Tony, things may appear fine, but they're having drastic consequences on our national defense as we speak. The fact that you had this debt ceiling vote coupled with a three-month CR means that the Department of Defense now is held hostage till January. They cannot contract. They cannot replace munitions. They cannot have any flexibility in their funding. They are held hostage to a continued resolution. Now, our enemies around the world are not held to any type of hostage situation. Dictators, they can streamline spending in a direction that they want to go. And so while our enemies are out there being very active, we now, as Congress, have just tied up Department of Defense until January. This is the chief reason, other than my anathema to debt ceiling increases, which I've not voted for, why I oppose this, and it was also why our delegation, even in the state of Oklahoma, was divided. James Lankford and I work an awful lot on waste and saving, and both of us were opposed to that.
You're listening to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. Glad to have you with us on this Tuesday afternoon. Our guest, Oklahoma Congressman Steve Russell, a retired member of the United States Army. And we're talking about the debt ceiling, temporary raise of the debt ceiling, allowing it to be raised further until December the 8th. I want to go back to something, Steve, you mentioned a few moments ago about Americans and how they spend and how we acquire debt. And it's not unlike that at the national level. Well, for the first time, and I don't know what comes first. Is it the government that kind of sets the tone that is leading consumers to spend money they don't have, or is it Americans that are spending and so the government follows suit? But for the first time, Americans this last year racked up $1 trillion collectively on their credit cards. That's a lot of money that Americans are spending that they don't have. And so is it this idea that we can just, spend without consequence, both at the governmental level and the individual level?
I think when you have the safety net where you know, hey, I don't really have a consequence here. If I'm out of sugar, I can go next door and get more sugar. But eventually, your neighbor's going to tire of that real quick. And the problem that you have with our bond debt and the bond holding, I was stunned, and I travel a lot, in the capacity of dealing with foreign affairs and national defense. But I was stunned when I was in Japan that they had an amazing ratio of debt in terms of what their bond debt was. It was a staggering figure. And I asked them, I said, well, aren't you worried about that? And they said, the difference between Japan and the United States is the Japanese citizens hold most of the bond debt of Japan. And I thought, wow, so they are saving and investing in their own future. And while they're worried about their debt holders are the Japanese people. That is not the case in the United States. Our debt holders are foreigners. And you go back and you look at this, and it reminds you of Exodus and Deuteronomy, where it says, look, if you do these things, you will have my blessing. If you don't do these things, you will have the following things happen. And one of those things is that you will be a debtor to other nations.
There are consequences, and you can't escape them. It's just a matter of time. So it really begins personally as individuals, as families, not to live beyond your means, and then demand that you have a government that does not live beyond its means as well. Hey, Congressman Russell, I want to talk to you. We're talking about this, the debt ceiling raise, talk about the fiscal issues going on, the Senate failing to repeal Obamacare, a lot happening in Washington. But tonight, President Trump is going to sit down with a bipartisan dinner at the White House. Three members of the Democratic Party, three members of the Republican Party. What do you think is going to come out of that?
You know, I think dialogue is always good. I've brought disparate groups together where these two different peoples were literally shelling each other's villages and killing one another. And if you can bring people like that together and get them to agree on wheat harvest, well, guess what? We can probably get Republicans and Democrats together to have a dialogue. I think the more that we talk and the more that we create these types of relationships, there's not bad that comes out of that. It's when we quit talking and when we shout over one another and when we become isolated and distrustful of one another, that's when we're headed the wrong direction. So I think it's good.
So on the menu tonight, do you think there's any discussion of various cuts of beef or pork on the menu? What's going to be at the core of the president's conversation?
I don't know what will be served, but I would hope there'd be a little humble pie on all of those that are there. We've got to lay aside some of the things where we pontificate or postulate or whatever it is and really look at, hey, we have a robust, wonderful country. There are very few Americans out there, regardless of political stripe, that do not love our country. Okay, right. So let's find what we agree on and not negotiate the non-negotiables. Let's find the things that we agree would be good to do, and then let's work from there. And I think the president has tried to do that when he's talking about infrastructure and when he's talking about building transportation initiatives in the country. We all agree on that. We all know roads and bridges and highways and infrastructure and rail and air and all of that is a good thing, but we have to do it on the ways that we can get it done and where we actually agree on those things. If we have a propensity to like those things, that's a starting point.
Well, I am with you, Congressman Russell. I think conversation is good, and I think if we can come together across party lines to address, starting with the issues that we can find agreement on, I think, eventually we can move some things forward. As always, Congressman Russell, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Well, and thank you, Tony, and for all that you do. Appreciate it.
Thank you, sir. Congressman Steve Russell of Oklahoma. Great guy. Really is a great American patriot. To find out more, go to the website, TonyPerkins.com. I think the dinner is going to be interesting. The president selected three of the most vulnerable Democrats from the Senate, Joe Donnelly, Heidi Heitkamp, and Joe Manchin of West Virginia. They'll be at dinner tonight with three Republican members of the Senate. I think the president's trying to find a way forward. He was blocked by some of his own Republicans, so I think he's looking for a way forward. All right, Lauren Green, chief religion correspondent from Fox News, joins us next to talk about her book. Don't go away. We're back with more of Washington Watch after this.
If you had to make a law, where would you start? Our founding fathers knew that God's transcendent truth must be the foundation for all law. Since the early 20th century, however, truth-based rule of law has changed dramatically in America. The progressive era ushered in big change, shifting our standards to make it appear that truth is ever-evolving. America's founding fathers determined truth from a fixed source, God. But progressives determined that truth originated with man, thereby making it possible to change the truth in order to fit shifting cultural opinions and to undergird the power of those elected in office. In an incisive new paper, Peter Johnston reveals the importance of truth founded in God and the consequences of moral relativism. Is truth fixed or is it subject to change? The future existence of our free democracy hinges on answering this question correctly. Go to frc.org/decay to learn more.
In America, we face a media onslaught against the Christian perspective. It is now seen as anti-cultural and invalid. Dr. Michael Paulson, a law professor at the University of St. Thomas, talked about how Christians can respond intellectually. Dr. Paulson has researched common arguments against religious liberty. For example, religious values are no different than ethical values. Dr. Paulson argues that the law should give religious exemptions because of the perspective of a religious person who necessarily believes in God as an ultimate source. Religion is different and necessitates a different kind of devotion. Moreover, the Constitution itself treats religion differently, giving America religious liberty and the freedom of exercise. The Christian perspective is one that is not outdated, but still present and still valid according to the Constitution. Visit frc.org/university to hear more about this issue.
Is being right enough to win an election? Many tend to believe that being right, in the sense of being factually correct, is sufficient to win in politics. Unfortunately, political history proves otherwise. The candidate who organizes and communicates the best will beat the opposition, no matter how right the other side is. Christians who are running for public office have a moral obligation to study and learn how to win. They must discover the real nature of politics. Robert Arnakis knows how to win. As senior director for the Leadership Institute, the nation's premier public policy training organization, he has 15 years of grassroots organizing, campaign, fundraising, and communications experience, and has established himself as one of the country's top political trainers. Here, Mr. Arnakis discussed the real nature of politics and how to overcome the odds to win an election. Go to frc.org/speakers to view this timely discussion.
This is Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins. Glad to have you along on this Tuesday afternoon. The website is tonyperkins.com. Lots of information there. If you happen to miss anything on your way home, on that drive home, you can find it all later at tonyperkins.com. It's all archived. Well, as we've discussed, the Truth Conference 2017 is scheduled this Friday and Saturday at my home church, Greenville Springs Baptist Church, right outside of Baton Rouge. The conference focuses on defining the absolutes of biblical truth in an ever-darkening world. How do you live the Christian life in a world that's increasingly turning its back on truth? Well, joining us now is Fox News Channel's chief religion correspondent, Lauren Green, and author of a new book, Lighthouse Faith, God as a Living Reality in a World Immersed in Fog. She's also one of our featured speakers at Truth Conference 2017. Lauren, welcome to Washington Watch.
It's great to be here. Thank you so much. I'm looking forward to Friday. I really am. It's a good time to be speaking with a lot of young people.
And I'm looking forward to hosting you in Baton Rouge. I was with you last week in New York City at Fox, and so I think you'll find Baton Rouge a little more accommodating of conservative values, biblical values, than maybe New York City. But I want to talk about that. I think so. But you have been with Fox News from day one.
You've been there
a while, and you have been living your faith in a vocation that is often, especially today, hostile toward faith. How do you do that?
It's hard. I think in a sense, and then easy in the other sense. I mean, I think that if you really understand the Gospels, if you understand what we're here for, that we are made to reflect God's glory, then you realize that, you know, it's never about me. It's never about me. It's all about, you know, doing God's will and living out the Great Commission, which is spreading the gospel. And you can do that with words, but you can not do that in a better way, actually, with your actions, with how you treat people, mm-hmm. and how, you know, live out the truth in love. And I think that's very, very much a part of the workplace, and not many people really understand how to do it. You know, one of the things that is very, very important for people to realize in this world is that for so long, and this is what Herbert Schlossberg talked about in his book, Idols for Destruction, a book that he wrote, in, I think, in the 70s and 80s, and he talked about how you know, we have been, America has really been living off the capital of Christianity. And it was the values that Christianity holds true were the values of America. Just, and so everybody believed it because everybody was part of this community that believed it. I mean, certain things that happen today that would seem so out of sync with what we believed was truth in the 1960s and 70s. And I think that's what happens is you've got a generation or a few generations of people living off the capital of a Christian doctrines with really not understanding why they're there. And then it becomes a habit. Ethics and morality become a habit.
Right.
But then the next generation comes in and I'm sorry, my phone's ringing. The next generation comes in and they don't have the habit. Or they push against the habit because there's no foundation there, right? Because it was just the collateral. It was just, you know, things that the people were doing. It was a habit.
They didn't know why.
Right. They didn't know why. And so I think that's why a truth conference like this is very, very important because it really gets back at the foundation of what. Why do you believe this? And you can reason Christianity. If Christianity is true, then you can reason. Then it's reasonable. There is knowledge that really brings you to it. You don't have to have this sort of blind faith, like a secular world will make you believe that, you know, anybody who is religious is just exercising blind faith. In fact, I just wrote, you know, one of my, you know, thoughts for the day, which is off my book, and I have these newsletters that I put out, you know, one thought for the day each day, Monday through Friday, and I use the example of a great scene from Raiders of the Lost Ark. To understand the verse from Proverbs 3:5, which is, trust in the Lord with all your heart and do not lean on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge him and he will direct your path. And a lot of secularists and atheists will say, see, you know, religious people just have this blind faith. They just have this blind faith. Where that's not true, because if you look at this wonderful, this climactic scene from the Raiders of the Lost Ark, and everybody remembers it, is when, you know, the Nazis are opening up the Ark of the Covenant, you know, and everything, and Indy and Marion are tied up, they can't get loose, and Indiana realizes that something is happening. And he tells Marion, close your eyes, don't look at it. Because even in his sort of secularist, you know, professorial sense, he had read the Hebrew scriptures, which says to look upon the face of God is death. And he knew something was happening. He tells her to close her eyes. And I say to people, I said, now, is Marion operating on blind faith, or is she simply putting her trust in an authority that has more knowledge than her? You see?
That's good.
See, and that's what that means. And so there are so many ways that secularists really try to break down faith as a sort of blindness. But the scriptures themselves say, test this. Knowledge of God is the beginning of wisdom. Not blind faith in God is the beginning of wisdom. Knowledge is the beginning of wisdom. And so I think people of faith must understand, especially millennials, need to understand that, you know, if this world is created by a loving and merciful and truthful God, then the science of this world is a direct conduit, really, to God.
Absolutely.
And the scriptures.
It points right back to him.
And the scriptures reflect it all the time.
Well, before we run out of time, I'm looking forward to having you in Baton Rouge on Friday. But your book, Lighthouse Faith, the focus, the premise, why'd you write it?
Well, one of the things is it came from the Ten Commandments and the sort of structure of the Ten Commandments, and that the first commandment, I am the Lord your God, you shall have no other gods before me, sits atop the other commandments, made like a light of the lighthouse. And that the first commandment is key, and you can't break commandments 2 through 10 without first breaking number 1. So everything hinges on keeping God first. And that, to me, was a structure that you could transfer into a lot of different things. You could transfer into the physical world. You could transfer into the spiritual world. But the lighthouse became now the divine messenger of that structure. And I just that to me was just, it said it all. And it was God speaking to me.
Well, folks, you can pick up a copy. To find out more, go to the website, TonyPerkins.com. Also, still room for you at the Truth Conference coming up Friday night and Saturday. Lauren, thanks so much for joining us. Look forward to seeing you on Friday.
Thanks so much, Tony. I'm looking forward to it.
All right, great. Thank you. Lauren Green, Chief Religion Correspondent at Fox News. To find out more, again, go to TonyPerkins.com. The book, Lighthouse Faith, God as a Living Reality in a World Immersed in Fog. It's good. Pick it up. All right, we're coming back with Dr. Carol Swain in just a moment. Don't go away.
Every day, the Christian worldview is increasingly being pushed out of the public square and out of public policy. Family Research Council is an organization that works to advance faith, family, and freedom in public policy and culture from a Christian worldview. We want you to know that we are your advocate in our nation's capital. To learn more about FRC, go to frc.org and follow us on social media to receive our action alerts and stay up to date on the latest news.
Is being right enough to win an election? Political history proves otherwise. The candidate who organizes and communicates the best will beat the opposition, no matter how right the other side is. Christians who are running for public office have a moral obligation to study and learn how to win. They must discover the real nature of politics. Robert Ornakis is one of the country's top political trainers. Hear him discuss the real nature of politics and how to overcome the odds to win an election at frc.org/speakers.
The Family Research Council had the pleasure of hosting Dr. Michael Paulson to speak about how Christians can respond to arguments against religious liberty. Dr. Paulson argues that religion is different and deems exemptions within the law. A religious person believes in God, and God's sovereignty requires complete devotion, whereas government only requires allegiance and civil duties. The Constitution itself treats religion differently, giving America religious liberty and the freedom to exercise. Visit frc.org/university to hear more about this issue.
If you had to make a law, where would you start? America's founding fathers determined law from a fixed source, God, but culture has shifted the focus to man's self-determined law. If truth is no longer determined by God, it becomes subjective and open to interpretation. In an incisive new paper, Peter Johnston traces the origins of these dangerous trends in American law and the importance of staying true to our founding principles. To view FRC's new publication, go to frc.org/decay.
Back to Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins. Glad to have you along. All right, as we have consistently reported here on Washington Watch, the Southern Poverty Law Center, SPLC, has recklessly labeled dozens of mainstream conservative organizations as hate groups. Now, this is, you know, we've made this very clear, and the media has been on it. Fox News has been covering it. They are a political advocacy group. A liberal one, and that's fine. They have the right to do that. I mean, everybody does. But they also hold themselves out as the arbiter of truth. And what they do is they label people who disagree with their political agenda. I was actually going back looking at this the other day. It just struck me. Actually, I was on with Tucker Carlson talking about it last week. They started labeling people 2 years into the Obama administration, labeling Christian organizations that were opposed to his radical social agenda, trying to marginalize them and silence them. Well, they've continued, but there are many pushing back because they have gone, well, I think they've gone a bridge too far. Joining us now is Dr. Carol Swain, author of Be the People and a conservative political commentator, is former professor of political science and law at Vanderbilt University. An amazing story of how, you know, she decided not to embrace the message of the left, worked at night, educating herself, making all the way through law school, and has had a very, very successful career. Well, Dr. Swain has now been labeled as an African-American woman. She has been labeled because they say she's hostile toward minorities. Joining us now is Dr. Swain. Carol, welcome back to Washington Watch.
It's my pleasure. And I have to, correct the narrative a little bit. Back in 2007, the Southern Poverty Law Center started attacking people who were immigration restrictionists. And at the time, I was a CNN contributor for Lou Dobbs and, you know, shared a lot of similar ideological interests with Lou Dobbs. And I noticed how they were attacking and discrediting organizations that were restrictionists on immigration. Eventually, in 2009, I wrote a blog where I pointed out that instead of them actually writing articles about things that related to hate, they were pursuing conservatives. And I ended my blog with the line that instead of monitoring hate groups, the Southern Poverty Law Center had become one. And so a month or so after I wrote my blog, October 2009, my local newspaper interviewed Mark Potok at the Southern Poverty Law Center. He accused me of being an apologist for white supremacy. I was on the front page of my local newspaper, not just the local newspaper, it was statewide newspapers, with the heading, Carol Swain is an apologist for white supremacy. And then the following year, they put me on hate watch. So their attack on me and conservatives goes back a lot further than the Christian organizations.
Right. And, well, let me, I mean, how's that work? How's an African-American woman who has had a very successful career, how do you come off as being an apologist for a white supremacist?
I mean, it's even more interesting because in 2002, I published a book with Cambridge University Press, the number one university press, titled The New White Nationalism in America, Its Challenge to Integration. And so I was like the foremost expert on white nationalism and white supremacy, and I still got placed on the list when I criticized the Southern Poverty Law Center for having mission creep. And mission creep, as you know, occurs when the organization, you know, starts out with a particular focus and then they sort of lose their way and they drift into other areas. So I accused them again in 2009 of having mission creep. A month later, there's an article in my local newspaper with my photograph and the heading that I'm an apologist for white supremacy. It was the worst thing that you can imagine, because at the time I did not have a platform. I could not really defend myself, and that was the first time that the Wall Street Journal, you know, they wrote an article in my defense, and that caused the criticisms to subside. And then the following year, I got placed on the hate watch. And so, I mean, I've been battling for a long time, not entirely alone, but I felt alone.
Well, this we're almost up against a break. Can you stick around through the break? And
yes.
So we can. Okay. Well, let me ask you this question. Let me make sure I got this straight. You were out, and I remember when you were on Lou Dobbs, because it was about the same time I developed a relationship with Lou Dobbs when he was at CNN. And it was over the issue of immigration. So they were really after you over the immigration issue, but to try to silence you, they wanted to tie you into this whole issue of white supremacy.
Not exactly. I got into trouble because I pointed out they were going after conservatives instead of hate groups. And so that's how I got in trouble with them. It was because I criticized them for mission creep.
Okay. All right. Well, hang on, because I want to, you had a piece today in the Wall Street Journal. I want to talk more about that and where this is going with the Southern Poverty Law Center. All right, folks, you're listening to Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins. Dr. Carol Swain, my guest. She's going to stick around to the other side of the break. She had a great piece today in the Wall Street Journal about what it's like to be smeared by the Southern Poverty Law Center. We're going to continue our conversation with her and then take your phone calls here on Washington Watch. Don't go away.
Are you worried about the moral direction of America? Do you feel powerless to make a difference? Family Research Council is an organization that works to advance faith, family, and freedom in public policy and culture from a Christian worldview. Established in 1983 in Washington, D.C., Family Research Council conducts research, develops policy, drafts legislation, and educates policymakers, pastors, and the grassroots. It testifies before Congress and shapes public debate through the media and internet. Every day, the Christian worldview is increasingly being pushed out of the public square and out of public policy. We want you to know that we are your advocate in our nation's capital. To learn more about Family Research Council, please visit us at frc.org and follow us on social media to receive our action alerts and stay up to date on the latest news. Again, that's frc.org.
Is being right enough to win an election? Many tend to believe that being right, in the sense of being factually correct, is sufficient to win in politics. Unfortunately, political history proves otherwise. The candidate who organizes and communicates the best will beat the opposition, no matter how right the other side is. Christians who are running for public office have a moral obligation to study and learn how to win. They must discover the real nature of politics. Robert Arnakis knows how to win. As senior director for the Leadership Institute, the nation's premier public policy training organization, he has 15 years of grassroots organizing, campaign, fundraising, and communications experience, and has established himself as one of the country's top political trainers. Here, Mr. Arnakis discusses the real nature of politics and how to overcome the odds to win an election. Go to frc.org/speakers to view this timely discussion.
If you had to make a law, where would you start? America's founding fathers determined law from a fixed source, God, but culture has shifted the focus to man's self-determined law. If truth is no longer determined by God, it becomes subjective and open to interpretation. In an incisive new paper, Peter Johnston traces the origins of these dangerous trends in American law and the importance of staying true to our founding principles. To view FRC's new publication, go to frc.org/decay.
The Family Research Council had the pleasure of hosting Dr. Michael Paulson to speak about how Christians can respond to arguments against religious liberty. Dr. Paulson argues that religion is different and deems exemptions within the law. A religious person believes in God, and God's sovereignty requires complete devotion, whereas government only requires allegiance and civil duties. The Constitution itself treats religion differently, giving America religious liberty and the freedom to exercise. Visit frc.org/university to hear more about this issue.
You're listening to Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins. Dr. Carol Swain, my guest, she has stuck around over the break. Dr. Swain, thanks for sticking around. In your piece today in the Wall Street Journal, you said being targeted by the SPLC has had a lasting impact on my life and career. Can you explain that impact to our listeners?
Well, I mean, it's pretty simple. I was a university professor until I took early retirement in August. But what university or which universities would want a professor that's been labeled, been placed on hate watch, or been called an apologist for white supremacy? And when, after they called me an apologist for white supremacy, it went viral on the black media. And Tom Joyner was the only person who eventually allowed me to come on his show and to give my side. And as I mentioned briefly before the break, the Wall Street Journal ran an article in defense of Carol Swain probably about 2 weeks after the article in the Tennessean. That caused some criticism to subside, but the following year I was listed in Hate Watch, and all of this was because I reviewed a film called A Conversation About Race. It was written by a guy that the Southern Poverty Law Center said was a bigot. He had criticized President Obama. And I did give the film a glowing review. And the reason I did is, as a professor, I have taught courses that relate to race and social sciences. There's always a liberal perspective. What I liked about A Conversation About Race, it was being told from the perspective of whites who felt they were being beaten up by allegations of racism. And so I thought it would be great for classroom use, and I was very enthusiastic. And as a consequence, that was the pretext for labeling me as a white supremacist, sympathizer, or an apologist. And then the following year, having my name in an article about the Hate Watch. And then several times over the years, the Southern Poverty Law Center has mentioned me. And it resulted in, whenever the Tennessean, my local newspaper, runs an article where they mentioned me. I'm always called the controversial Carol Swain.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that has been going on ever since the Southern Poverty Law Center labeled me as an apologist for white supremacy. So, of course, it affects your opportunities to go to other universities, to get speaking engagements, to appear on TV. It limits you quite a bit.
So is it designed then to basically silence conservatives? Because look, let's face it, this was about your conservative ideology. It wasn't about the color of your skin.
Yeah, it's designed to discredit people, and you know, so that others will not take you seriously. And within academia, where about 95% of the professors are liberal, it has a lasting impact. And we know with the mainstream media how liberal they lean. They're not going to call someone to be on television as an expert, even though, you know, I'm the expert on white nationalism, if they have that kind of labeling. Now, over the years, it's subsided, and I've been able to get, you know, back on TV some, but it had a lasting impact on my career. And I'm not an organization like your organization. A lot of the Christian organizations have resources they can fight. When the Southern Poverty Law Center goes after a lone individual, they are less likely to have the resources to defend themselves.
Mm-hmm. Without question. But since you actually have a longer history with the Southern Poverty Law Center than we do, not making their list until 2010 when they started turning their attention to Christian groups who were, as I mentioned earlier, opposing Barack Obama's agenda. Do you think that the Southern Poverty Law Center, that more people are catching on to their game, that this is about trying to silence by labeling, marginalizing their political opponents?
But, Tony, I'm always ahead of my time. Anyone that's looked at my research knows that. So back in 2009, I pointed out that they had started showing evidence of mission creep and that they were going after conservatives. So they went after immigration restrictionists first. They went after me because I was going after them, and then eventually they worked their way, you know, to Christian organizations. And so once you're labeled, it makes it so much – well, you know, it probably makes it more difficult for your organization to raise money.
That's what it's designed to do, but I think for us, I think what it has not had that effect – and that's what so frustrates them, is that they've not been able to have that effect upon us because of the platform we have. And now I actually think they're in the crosshairs of many because...
Well, they are. You know something? I think this is a great opportunity. There's no way that members of Congress should have an organization with their checkered background offering testimony or advising any agencies of government or the media, and so I think they have zero credibility, and they have done nothing to redeem themselves. In fact, they dig in deeper whenever you criticize them.
Mm-hmm. Well, by the way, today, Richard Cohen, president of the Southern Poverty Law Center, was to have testified before the House Homeland Security Committee about threats posed by domestic extremist groups, all none on the left, because they refused to label them or track them. But the hearing was postponed because of Hurricane Irma. Do you think that they should not, they should rescind that invitation to Cohen and not let him speak when they hold that hearing?
I absolutely do. In fact, I had started drafting that opinion piece when I heard that they were invited to testify. And so I absolutely don't believe that Congress should have an organization with a background like theirs when it comes to attacking individuals and organizations because of their ideological positions, to give them that kind of platform. And they don't use objective criteria when they are making decisions about which organizations or individuals to place on their hate group. And, you know, the research that I've done makes a clear distinction between the neo-Nazis, the Klan, and extreme hate groups. Those numbers are very, very tiny. And because the Southern Poverty Law Center raises money based on hype about the growing white nationalism, the growing extremists, they have an incentive to keep inflating the numbers. So they have to add the churches, and they have to add the conservatives. They have to add anyone they can find to make it seem like it's a great threat. It's part of a fundraising scam.
It is interesting you say that, because actually looking at the FBI statistics on hate crimes and such like that, they actually show decreases when SPLC shows these increases of groups. And what we found out in looking at their numbers, that if they've identified a post office box somewhere for some group that they label a hate group, they put that on the list. So they do inflate the numbers. It's
well, you
clear.
Know something. Another way I noticed them inflating the numbers is that back again around the time I was doing my research for the New White Nationalism, there were some militia groups that started that were concerned about immigration not being addressed, and then we've always had the League of the South and the Daughters of the Confederacy and Southern Heritage groups. They started expanding, you know, the groups that they were going to consider hate groups to include patriot groups like Tea Parties, as well as anything that said militia. Any organization that had to do with Southern heritage found themselves on their hate group list. And then, you know, it was only a matter of time before they would go from immigration restrictionists to churches and other organizations that promote conservative values and principles.
And finally, Carol, to go back to a point you made about the standards or lack thereof, I mean, as you were doing your research, I mean, you have academic standards that you operate by to identify these groups and explain them. They don't operate with academic standards. They basically use political standards to slap that label on whomever they wish.
They do. And, I mean, they're dangerous because they have so much money and they can do harm to individuals, as well as, you know, smaller organizations. And so maybe FRC and some of the larger groups have not been harmed. But when you are attacking an individual, it greatly affects their opportunities. And as you know, I'm a devout believer, and I believe God raised me up. He gave me my platform. And so they were not able to totally stop me or take away my platform, but I do believe that they affected my professional career and led to the circumstances that caused me to leave academia early. But, you know, I'm doing what I'm doing. I'm doing my thing. And right now I am proud to be part of the people who are trying to expose the hypocrisy and the danger of the Southern Poverty Law Center.
Well, Dr. Carol Swain, I, for one, appreciate you, your courage, your boldness, and I will be praying. Let me just put it this way. I'll be praying that God would give you that platform that eclipsed anything you ever had because of your boldness and your courage and your commitment to truth. So thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. Bye.
Dr. Carol Swain, by the way, she'll be on Tucker Carlson tonight talking about this piece that she wrote. And speaking of platform, I should have said this before she left, I will be giving her a platform at the Values Voter Summit. She's going to be a part of a panel, Political Intimidation, at the Values Voter Summit in Washington, which is October 13th and 14th. Look, let me tell you what, I've spent some time with Carol. She's a remarkable story, just a remarkable story. And, you know, she's a great lady. She really is. And so anyway, you can find out more about her. Get her book. Go to TonyPerkins.com. And also make plans to come to the Values Voter Summit. You can meet Carol and hear her. That's October 13th and 14th. All right, you're going to take a couple of calls here. I really wanted to finish that conversation with Carol, so we're not going to have as many calls, much time for calls. But let me ask you this. Staying on this issue of Southern Poverty Law Center, I want to talk about the debt ceiling, but I'm going to stay on this issue. What do you think SPLC is trying to accomplish by labeling Christians and conservatives as haters? What do you think is really behind this? Let's go to, already got some calls lined up. Let's go to Memphis, Tennessee, where Dale is on the line. Dale, welcome to Washington.
Tony, the reason, what's behind it, Tony, it's strictly raising money. You know, back in the 20s, they said there were approximately 2 million members of the Klan back in the 20s. Now, back in, then in the 70s, but maybe in the United States right now, there's probably 2,000 members of the Klan. And what they do is they go after white, liberal white guilt to get the money to roll in. And if all of a sudden that area is getting cleaned up, what do they have to do? They have to look at other issues to keep the money flowing into the system. So what have they done? They've looked at abortion, at immigration, at gay marriage, and start classifying all these things as civil rights. And if you have a difference of opinion pertaining to these things, you're classified as a hate monger.
Right.
So in effect, what they do is they're just playing on the emotions of individuals. And it's all about raising money. That's right. Strictly what it is. They have no principle because they won't even allow the debate about things. You know, I mean, that's just the way.
Dale, I think you're absolutely well. The facts say you are right. Number one, they have, and there's some debate over the exact amount of money, but I know it's somewhere in the neighborhood of $350 million that they are sitting on. $350 million. And the dispute is over how much of that is in offshore bank accounts. There was a Weekly Standard report that came out that I think they said like a third of that was in offshore accounts. Information we've seen says it's a little higher than that. But no question. I mean, $350 million, I mean, that's a lot of money. And they're still raising it. You know, in the wake of Charlottesville, liberals gave, million here, million there. And to your point about the labeling and silencing, I've used this example before, but it's one of the most egregious. It was in Minnesota where they pushed this liberal policy on it was a anti-bullying program, but it was all about promoting homosexuality. And so parents, local parents of the students, rose up and said, hey, we don't want that in here. And they were successfully pushing back on the SPLC, and the SPLC, angered by the fact that the parents would dare challenge them, labeled the parents' group a hate group in order to marginalize and silence them. That's how they operate. All right, very quickly, going to try to work in another call here before we go before we're out of time. Daniel Baton Rouge, you got 30 seconds.
Hey, Reverend Perkins, thank you. How you doing?
Great, thanks.
Yes, sir. I just wanted to thank you for interviewing Dr. Swain. And I agree with the previous caller about what the SPLC is doing. And I just wanted to, thank the Dr. Swain for her Christian stance, both of you, for, to stand up for the Lord and, taking on that persecution. And just wanted to apologize, for her for what they've done, trying to smear her and,
It's a shame. It's an absolute shame what they've done to her, Daniel. An African American woman who is a success story and a brilliant lady. And they've labeled her to try to marginalize and silence her. Folks, pray for her. Pray, as I said a moment ago, that the Lord would give her a platform that far exceeds, eclipses anything she ever had. Out of time for today. Thanks so much for joining us. Check out the website, TonyPerkins.com. Until next time, you remember what the Apostle Paul said in Ephesians 6. He says, when you've done everything you can do, like Carol, when you've done everything you can do, when you've prayed, when you've prepared, and when you've taken your stand, by all means, keep standing.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is a production of the Family Research Council in Washington, D.C. For more information on anything you heard today, or if you'd like to find out how you can support the ongoing efforts of the Family Research Council, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our new watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.